and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with freshman Senator Rand Paul's entry into the 2016 Republican presidential primary race under the banner "Defeat the Washington Machine, Unleash the American Dream." A former senior policy advisor to Rand Paul's father, Ron Paul's 2012 presidential campaign, Bruce Fine, joins us. We will discuss the extent to which the Kentucky senator will campaign on principle or moderate his message to appeal to Republican primary voters who may not be ready for the legalization of pot, cutting the Pentagon's budget, and downsizing the American empire. Then we will speak with Ian Millhiser, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He is the author of the new book Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And we will discuss his article at Think Progress, Rand Paul Would Be the Worst President on Civil Rights Since the 1800s. Then finally, as President Obama heads to Jamaica for a meeting with the Caribbean community CARICOM leaders before going on to Panama for the Summit of the Americas, we will look into how the third year of an IMF-backed plan has Jamaica running the most austere budget in the world, worse than Greece's, to the point where the tiny island nation's interest payments on its debt is over 8% of GDP. Jake Johnston, the author of a new report from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Partners in Austerity, Jamaica, the United States, and the International Monetary Fund, joins us. And joining us now is Bruce Fine, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as an Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director for the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the U.S. Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. Bruce Fine is the author of a number of books. His latest is American Empire Before the Fall. He has been a senior policy advisor to Ron Paul's 2012 campaign and was a lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bruce Fine.
Thank you for inviting me in.
And today, Rand Paul announced he's running for president of the United States, and his father, Ron Paul, introduced him at a rally in Louisville, Kentucky. How different is the son from the father?
It's clear there is a difference. I think it's clear that, you know, the father will not be playing, you know, a prominent role in the campaign, supportive, but clearly maybe like an extra in a Cecil B. DeMille extravaganza. I don't think there's closeness, personal relationship. I think that Rand is what you might call more devoted to gathering a political opportunity to win election than campaign for a philosophical crusade, which I think was Ron Paul's approach, and I give him credit for that. I think that Rand is, in my judgment, far superior to all the other candidates in adhering to the Constitution, especially the Constitution's foreign policy of billions for defense, not 1 cent for empire. But I think that as he runs for the campaign and he looks at the election demographics, he probably may veer to what many would call the centrist position, unlike his father. And it's just different approaches to trying to change the political landscape. One is a longer-term approach, and I think Ron Paul deserves great credit for having been in the wilderness for years and years and changing the debate, even if he didn't win office. I think that Rand sort of capitalizing on that is more politically oriented, but certainly philosophically far and away the superior candidate to the others who would want to have the United States fight endless wars and spy on us without warrants and bail out the crony capitalists.
So do you think then that Rand Paul is, if he's being a politician and has to sort of tone down his rhetoric in order to win, he has to appear more religious than perhaps he is, he has to forget about legalizing pot, because it's not going to play well with the Republican primary, and certainly he's already backtracked on his military spending. So Is that to say then that there are two Rand Pauls, the heart versus the head? The head tells him he's got to moderate his position in order to get elected. So would you be safe in saying that he still believes the stuff that he said earlier?
Yes, I don't know whether, Ian, that I would share that bifurcation between, two Rand Pauls, kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I simply think that when you think about how to change our political orientation, how to change the political culture, there are two different approaches, and there's not one that's necessarily superior to the other. One approach, and this is just who I am, is just to go out and whether or not you can win votes in the short run, you stake out a philosophical position and argue it and try to change the grammar of the debate. I think Ron Paul did that with regard to the Federal Reserve and many things. And even if you don't get credit because you've been parachuted into office, you've actually changed the politics. Another approach is, and a single person can switch from one to the other, is, well, you've got to get into power before you can change things. Then you have some discretion, molecular discretion, to maneuver from where your campaign platform was. And it's better overall to tack, if you will, and instead of moving between two points in a straight line, even if it means there's some watering down or dilution of philosophical purity. And I think when you're running a campaign, the attempt to dilute is ordinarily the most powerful one when people who are operating the campaigns have a zeal for occupying office rather than vindicating, a Socratic philosophical point.
But we all know, Bruce Fein, how much money dominates our politics, and it's more often than not really a money race, and he who raises the most money, it's almost like a weapon. If you raise the most money, you intimidate the other guys to get out of the race, and we know that it's a pretty crowded field on the Republican side.
I think what you say, Ian, is certainly a sound observation, but I think it has its limits, too. There's no doubt that Mitt Romney had staggering amounts of money. It didn't make him a steamroller, a juggernaut. And at present, if your observation was accurate without reservation, Jeb Bush would already have the nomination. He's got so much money poured in already. But my view is that he will end up a dismal middle of the pack, despite his money. Now, it's not to say that money isn't exceptionally influential, you accurately point out. You're not going to win if you have no money. But money alone is not a winner. If that was true, Michael Bloomberg would be president of the United States, and he's not. But it surely does say, I think, that without a substantial bankroll, you are not going to get into the presidency, even though you don't necessarily have to be a multi-billionaire in order to achieve a position in the Oval Office.
Well, what I was going to ask you there, Bruce, was do you think that with Rand Paul's contacts in the Silicon Valley, and I believe he also met with the Koch brothers, do you think he can raise enough money to have a viable run?
Yes, I do. I think that he has a substantial enough base, and I think he has an overlapping support that he picks up from his father's 2012 campaign, which received tens of millions of dollars, to make certain that his he has an opportunity to give his message out there. Now, I do say that I believe that he confronts a greater challenge than all the other candidates because he is trying to change our orthodoxies about thinking in foreign policy, even if he hedges from time to time, from one where we automatically assume that we govern the world, we have to conquer the world, domination for the sake of domination in a foolish attempt to try to reduce risk to zero. And it's true that Rand did propose this amendment that enlarged the military budget, but he had offsetting cuts, and it really was, I've written, a clumsy move to try to suggest that his competitors, like Lindsey Graham, they want military spending with no cuts, which is the opposite of limited government, which they tout themselves as proposing. But I do think that Rand will be able to use the presidential campaign as a platform to make his case. And at that point, it's up to him. But I do think also that he does confront a huge military-industrial complex whose compensation, whose stature is threatened by Rand. There was a group just yesterday that announced a neocon group was going to buy $1 million in ads time over the next several months in running 80, 90 ads a day on the Internet, all denouncing his foreign policy and suggesting that we'd be overrun by Iran and ISIS and Al-Qaeda and maybe even Chad and Boko Haram, because he would surrender. That kind of utterly absurd exaggeration. And that's something that he's going to have to confront with, going to have to very quick and profound response team.
Well, Rand Paul has taken a fairly principled and thoughtful stand on some issues that sort of political taboo in America. For example, he's criticized the failed war on drugs, and he's also criticized the so-called prison industrial complex and the extent to which generations of young African-American men are incarcerated. So he's talking about some stuff that you'd normally hear from liberals, except I don't think there are too many liberals running at this point. There's only one on the Democratic side running, and that hasn't
I wouldn't call the one on the Democratic side, Ian, a liberal.
Well, she's not running yet either.
Yeah. She's got the hawkishness of John McCain. If you took her quotes and John McCain's, you'd find them indistinguishable on the war machine. But putting that aside, what you say is accurate. On the other hand, I do think it's fair to say there have been conservative groups, including the Koch brothers and Grover Norquist, who have supported Rand with prison reform or with doing away with the so-called war on drugs. And you've got places like Colorado and Washington State who have clearly decriminalized marijuana use. But I go back in terms of what ails the country, in my view, Ian, those are really tiny. The military-industrial complex, over $1 trillion a year, permanent warfare, leads to the surveillance state. It leads to gross distortions of our separation of powers. We have one branch government rules by decree, runs executive orders and agreements rather than treaties. That is by far the greatest peril that the country confronts. And if we don't address that soon, our whole democracy will crumble. You know, with $18 trillion in national debt, $6 trillion alone in Iraq and Afghanistan, and doing nothing other than putting in more and more troops to a failed policy. It reminds me of the Vietnam War after the Tet Offensive, where Westmoreland asked for 200,000 more troops. That was, because of light at the end of the tunnel. You know, as though as you fail, you then redouble your efforts at the same strategy. And if you just look where where we are every day, Yemen, Libya, Nigeria, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, the whole thing is a disaster. And we have all of our arms over there that are being used by all the enemy forces to shoot and kill each other. And we continue down the same road. That, if we don't cure that, the other things will seem very, very minor or marginal in comparison.
So do you think that Rand Paul will bring up, you mentioned the money we spend, but it doesn't even matter, apparently, whether these incredibly expensive weapon systems work, like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which is a complete boondoggle. Everybody that knows anything about it says it's a disaster and it's much, much worse than anything it replaces and doesn't do anything well, but it's the most expensive weapon system in history. We also just learned today that the State Department and the White House have been hacked by Russian hackers. So, where is all of this cyber money going? I mean, it feels like we need a real auditor out there to basically...
Accountability is what we need. You're exactly right, Ian. And I think for your audience, the F-35, the budget is $400 billion. They've allocated $400 billion for one aircraft that doesn't work. I mean, you tell you, even the bankers, even AIG wasn't that bad. And you're exactly right, Ian. When Donald Rumsfeld, the day before 9/11, gave a press conference, he said there's $2.3 trillion in funds in the Pentagon that couldn't be accounted for. Transactions, $2.3 trillion. You can't even audit the books. and there's no accountability. Failure after failure after failure. There are no demotions. Nobody loses a job. Nobody has their budget cut. It's all more, more, more. So what do we have this great, great army for? And it's like, you know, in teachers, now we insist that they actually teach the students, but somehow the military people don't actually have to prevail in the wars that they say they can fight and win, and they keep getting more and more money. This is truly the word insanity it applies here. More is spending more and more as we have more and more failures, and we think that we're going to turn political cultures that are pre-Magna Carta stage in the, you know, the Pleistocene age, we're going to make them democracies and they're going to have separation of powers. I mean, the whole thing is lunatic. You remember months ago we were talking about we're going to train the moderate Syrian rebels who were going to be in favor of freedom of religion, and they're going to be trained in Saudi Arabia, an odd place to train people for freedom of religion, and they're going to be the ground troops that were going to carry the day against Assad and ISIS. You know, we haven't even trained one, you know? Right. It's ridiculous. And where can we find one? It's like Diogenes looking for an honest man, you know? We'll be spending 50 years before we find, you know, a liberal, Democrat, Syrian, Sunni rebel, you know? Well. And nobody's willing here, Ian, to say the emperor's got no clothes on, because there's so much money and power and stature at stake.
Well, Bruce, you made a great speech, but you're not running for president. But I thank you for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks, Ian. Have a great evening.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Bruce Fein, who's a constitutional lawyer who formerly served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Reagan Administration, General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission, Research Director of the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran, and a member of the American Bar Association's Task Force on Presidential Signing Statements. He has authored several volumes on the U.S. Supreme Court, the United States Constitution, and international law, and helped write the articles of impeachment for President Nixon and President Clinton. He's the author of a number of books, the latest of which is American Empire Before the Fall, and he has been a senior policy advisor to the Ron Paul 2012 campaign and was a lawyer for Edward Snowden's father, Lon. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with the author of an article, Rand Paul Would Be the Worst President on Civil Rights Since the 1800s.
Come, you masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind discs. I just don't want you.
Once a young American.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress's Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He is the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, Rand Paul Would Be the Worst President on Civil Rights Since the 1800s. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
Good to be back. Thanks so much.
And Rand Paul, of course, is a libertarian, but he is a Republican, and he's running for the Republican presidential ticket, and he's made his announcement today, and he's made certain compromises with his own earlier stated beliefs and philosophies, particularly on defense spending, where he's done a complete about turn. What did you make from his speech today announcing that he's running for president of the United States in 2016?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about Rand Paul is that he tries to sell himself as a libertarian, and of course, libertarianism is this notion of a generalized skepticism about government, but he gave, you know, a speech that called for a fairly robust foreign policy that you wouldn't expect a libertarian to support. You know, he supported keeping marijuana illegal, he doesn't support marriage equality, he doesn't support abortion rights. And so, you know, even though he's selling himself as if he has these libertarian leanings, and there are a few things that he's f- relatively moderate on, such as criminal justice. But even though he's selling himself this way, what he really is he's just a guy who doesn't want the government to help poor people. He doesn't want the government to spend money. He doesn't want the government to regulate business. So, you know, I think what you saw is that you are seeing what the things are that Rand Paul really does care about. And those are things like, you know, making sure that we don't have government regulation of health care. And you're seeing the things that he doesn't care about. And, you know, he's willing to compromise his previously stated principles on things like whether we should go to war.
Well, his motto is defeat the Washington machine, unleash the American dream. And again, it sounds like there's a bit of a gulf between the heart and the head here with Rand Paul, that if he really believes the stuff that he's been saying in the past, much of which has appealed to liberals, they particularly, you know, the freedom to smoke marijuana and getting out of foreign wars. But on the other hand, he really enunciates the pure libertarian philosophy when it comes to big business. And, you know, as I say, he's, in terms of his head, he sounds like he is just being a pragmatic politician trying to win the nomination, which means he has to curry favor with the Christian right and with the defense hawks like John McCain. Is that what's going on here?
No, I mean, I think it's certainly true that, you know, one thing you could definitely say about Ron Paul is he's a very skilled and very talented politician. And his political instincts are right, that in a Republican presidential primary, he's not going to win a lot of points if he's talking like a pacifist, you know, nor is he going to win a whole lot of points if he makes the focus of his campaign legalized marijuana. I mean, that's just the voters that he has to deal with. But at the same time, if he campaigns this way, if he doesn't have the courage to say, I'm going to go out on a limb when it comes to my foreign policy, when I'm announcing my campaign, and I haven't even had to prove myself on anything, then it's a pretty good sign that if someday he were a president, he would also act the same way. And we could also expect him, you know, not to have the more restrained foreign policy that you might have thought he would have from his previous statement.
Well, I'm sure he would like to be taken seriously as somebody that could actually occupy the White House, but not too many people think he's got much of a chance, do they?
I mean, well, what Rand Paul's problem is that on these core issues of domestic policy, he is so extreme. I mean, as you said, the name of the piece I wrote about him today is Rand Paul would be the worst president on civil rights since the 1880s. He would be the worst president on civil rights since Rutherford B. Hayes, who was the president who ended Reconstruction after the Civil War. And the reason I make that claim, you know, I don't actually think that Rand Paul's a racist. I think that Rand Paul is a good-hearted person who is just too naive to understand how the world works. And in his naivete, he has said over and over again, going back to when he was in college and throughout his adult life, that we shouldn't have anti-discrimination laws. You know, he famously said when he was running for Senate that not believing in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans whites-only lunch counters, is the hard part of believing in freedom. So, you know, his concept of freedom is that it is more important to protect the business owner who might want to exclude someone because they're black than it is to protect ordinary Americans from being victims of discrimination. And, you know, that's the sort of view that frankly, I don't think most Republicans think that way. I mean, I think we have a national consensus at this point that, you know, granted we're having this fight right now about whether the same thing applies to gay people, but then you can't turn someone away from your business because you don't like their skin color.
Again, I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of the new book, Injustices, The Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, Rand Paul Would Be the Worst President on Civil Rights Since the 1800s. So is this simply, though, the nature of libertarians? To my mind, Ian Millhiser, the libertarians the charge against liberals used to be that they're dreamers, that they're idealists,
right,
that it's not anchored in reality. And it's always been a kind of patronizing charge. And you can actually look at all the great issues that the American people have faced over the last couple of centuries, and actually it was the liberals who did the heavy lifting. They ended slavery, they ended enabled women to vote, ended child labor, got the U.S. into World War II to defeat the fascists before they took over the most of the world. An awful lot of and all the while the conservatives just said no. It's just they didn't offer anything. They just said no. So that's always been a specious charge, that the liberals are the dreamers and that the conservatives are the are practical people. But to my mind, the real dreamers in the political lexicon are the libertarians, because they have these perfectly well thought out sort of mechanistic notions of running a perfect world, but they forget about the human factor.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, the problem with libertarianism is that it's exactly like communism. And what I mean by that is that the reason why communism doesn't work is because you ask a communist any question, they're going to give you the exact same answer. You know, you tell a communist that not enough people have health care, they're going to say we've got to nationalize the means of production, and that'll fix it. You tell them that we've got, you know, a problem with out-of-control cops, we've got to nationalize the means of production. If it's raining out, they'll tell you that. You tell the exact same thing to a libertarian, and they say we got to get government out of the problem. So, if you're sick, we got to get government out of the problem. If it's raining, we got to get government out of the problem. And that's not how governance works. I mean, you know, the bottom line is that government is hard. You know, governing well requires study. It requires you to examine the specifics of the community you're working in, how the people will react to your proposals, what the relevant industries are doing, what, you know, the economists tell you. It requires you to examine each problem that comes your way at a very deep level and to come up with a solution that is tailored to what you're trying to solve. And, you know, so this is ultimately why I think that isms of any kind are a bad idea in government. You know, government is a process of learning and discovery. And if you think you have the answer before you ask the question, you're doing it wrong.
So in terms of Rand Paul's access to the press, I mean, it seems like he's very touchy. Whenever he's been criticized, for example, for plagiarizing, which he clearly did, he didn't acknowledge that he plagiarized. He just said this was a hit job by the press. And earlier on in his career, he spent an awful lot of time talking with this crackpot right-wing 9/11 truther, Alex Jones. He's not doing that anymore. But the impression you get is that that's the earlier guy is the real guy. The current guy is just a pragmatic politician trying to win the presidency.
Yeah, no, I think it's certainly true that, you know, there is the Rand Paul that tries to sell himself, and there's the Rand Paul who, you know, is what he actually believes in. You know, you saw this almost immediately after he got his party's nomination for his Senate seat. He stops talking in very direct terms about how we shouldn't have anti-discrimination laws. He gave one interview to MSNBC. It was a disaster for him, and he hasn't made that mistake again. I went looking, and I couldn't find a more recent quote where he says, yeah, I think we should eliminate anti-discrimination laws. You know, what I do find is I find him, you know, vocally articulating a theory, a way of reading the Constitution that would make it impossible for us to have anti-discrimination laws or much regulation of the workplace at all. I see him, you know, pushing a budget that would strip down our safety net until it had so many holes it was barely worth anything. So, you know, I see him pushing these agendas often in subtler and less open ways. But, yeah, I mean, what I can say for him is that he's an extraordinarily talented politician, and he clearly knows that, like, there are certain things that he believes that he shouldn't be saying on TV if he wants to get elected.
Well, he did seem to throw a bone to the religious right, who are obviously the people that Ted Cruz, who's the first to enter the race, Republican race, he's courting them right as we speak now in Iowa. And what Rand Paul said today was, you know, started out with a preface, with God's help and the American people's votes, I'll become president. So he invoked God. But he also, in his speech, got a lot of applause for saying, I'm going to get rid of the special interests who have captured Washington. Well, let's face it, the biggest special interest in this country in terms of spending money on politics and in order to get tax breaks and relief and get the EPA off their back and all the other government agencies that they hate because they just simply want to make money without any social responsibility, are the Koch brothers. I would make the case that the Koch brothers are the ultimate special interest in the United States. And, you know, one of them ran for president on the Libertarian ticket, and they claim to be libertarians, and Rand Paul claims to be a libertarian. So it struck me as an enormous sort of inconsistency there that he's talking about getting rid of the special interests when, and he went courting literally on bended knee to get Koch brothers money and support. So to my mind, that's just a massive hypocrisy.
Yeah, no, I mean, if he wanted to reduce the impact of special interests, there are things he could do. You know, he could work across the aisle to pass, to do things to mitigate the Citizens United decision so that at least if we can't get the money out of politics, we could have more disclosure so we know who's giving it. You know, he has not done that. You know, I think that, you know, you're going to see when his disclosures come out that he's getting donations from, you know, the same wealthy people who tend to give to other politicians. And, you know, I think what you're going to see is that, you know, he doesn't really have much more than rhetoric to offer as to how he's going to make sure to limit the impact of lobbyists and well-moneyed interest groups in Washington. In fact, the one idea he's offered in that regard, you know, this may be an unpopular position, but the one idea that he's offered is counterproductive, which is that he's called for term limits in Congress. Now, term limits are one of those ideas that sound great, but what's actually happened in the states that have implemented term limits is you lose the people in office who have institutional memory. And without the people in office who have institutional memory, someone has to basically tell the lawmakers how to do their job. And you know who those folks wind up being? Winds up being the lobbyists. Winds up being the people who are paid by the special interest to influence the lawmakers. So, you know, I mean, if that's what Paul wants to do, I am eager to see what his ideas are. I have not yet seen any ideas out of him which suggest that he, you know, he has an agenda beyond his rhetoric.
Well, again, it's totally in step with the Koch brothers. They want to buy the government and own it and use it for their ends, and all the while saying that government is the problem and you have to shrink it down and to the size where you can drown it in the bathtub. That's the mantra that they follow. But but obviously the tactic of term limits also serves the interests of drowning it in the bathtub because, you know, if you can't get rid of government and if you can't own it outright, then you can cripple it through term limits.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually think that, the Koch brothers' agenda and, you know, for that matter, Rand Paul's agenda is to seize control of government. You know, they want to eliminate governments. And, you know, there's a reason for that. You know, I discussed this a bunch in my book, Injustices, is that, you know, around the time of the Industrial Revolution, you know, we reached a point where in a modern economy, you can have, you know, you can have corporations that are powerful enough that their power rivals that of government. And, you know, Rand Paul and people like him and the Koch brothers like to tell a narrative about what America was like at the founding. They like to say that, you know, we shouldn't have government because the founders believed that government was dangerous. It was a source of too much concentrated power, so we should reduce its power. That's not even true that that's what the founders believed. But even if it were true, you know, that's not the world we live in now. The world we live in now is a world where, you know, you have two competing power centers. You have the corporate power center, and you have the power center that the people actually have some control over, the government. And if you don't use governance to check the power of these massive combinations of money, then they wind up running everything.
Well, but it leads you to wonder then, why do the Koch brothers spend more than anybody else and organize their billionaire friends? They had that big secret meeting recently here in Southern California in Newport Beach, where they basically set up this huge fund to defeat Hillary Clinton. So why are they buying politicians if they don't want to basically have the government work for them and for nobody else?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, their agenda, and to a certain extent, I think that, you know, Rand Paul's agenda is to have the government work for no one. If the government is, you know, as you said, so small it could be drowned in the bathtub, then, like, you know, if you're David Koch, you don't have to control the government to get your way. You have billions and billions of dollars and a huge company at your disposal. You can use that to get your way, and no one's going to be able to stop you, because the only force powerful enough to rein in a company of that size is a sovereign governmental entity.
So do you think that any of this that we're talking about will come up? Will anybody challenge Rand Paul, you know, to be honest about who he really is and use his extraordinary record against him? I mean, all of the stuff that he's been saying is either on audio or video. So
Right. You
could put together an incredible case where he could spend the rest of the campaign defending what he's already said now that he's changed his tune on some of the basic things, particularly on military spending and foreign policy.
Right, yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, the trouble that anyone has running for president is they've got to win two elections. They got to win their primary election. They got to win their general election. So, you know, in the primary election, I'm sure that there are going to be plenty of his opponents who are much more hawkish than he is, who are going to be saying, who's the real Rand Paul? Is it the more pacifistic Rand Paul from a few years ago, or is it the I want to win the presidency Rand Paul from now? And I think that, you know, of course, in the general election, he's going to have someone who's going to say, well, okay, what about the statement that we shouldn't have a ban on whites-only lunch counters? You know, what about your plans to cut 30% of food stamps? What about your plans to gut Medicaid? You know, what about when you said that you think that things like the minimum wage laws are unconstitutional? You know, I mean, I think there's no question he's going to be challenged because, you know, if nothing else, there are people who have an incentive to challenge him.
Well, Ted Cruz wants to ban the IRS and Rand Paul wants to ban the EPA and the Department of Education. And on his website, on the page that points out his education proposals, they misspelt the word education, which is not the most auspicious start. So
they also, by the way, they misspelled the word ophthalmologist, which is what he used to do for a living.
Well, it looks like he and Ted Cruz are going to be fighting over the for the so-called low information voter.
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly going to be fighting for a certain kind of vote. I mean, you know, there's no secret to what's happened to our politics. Our nation is very polarized. And, you know, as the Republican Party becomes more and more conservative, Republican Party primaries become a race to say who can say they want to eliminate the most agencies and who can say they want to cut food stamps the most. And, as seems to be the case even with Paul, who could be the most belligerent in their rhetoric about foreign policy? Right. And, okay, like, you know, that's how things are going to be in the primary. I think the question that they're ultimately going to have to ask themselves is, like, as they start to generate candidates who, you know, who think those ways, who are they going to have who's going to want to vote for them once someone emerges from out the other end?
Well, it's already Alice in Wonderland on the Republican side. If we are to believe that Jeb Bush is a liberal or a moderate, this is an incredibly conservative guy, and already he's being portrayed by the Tea Party and the Republican right as a moderate. So already the definitions are completely meaningless. Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us here today, Ian Millhauser.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. This has been fun.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhauser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. He has an article at Think Progress, Rand Paul would be the worst president on civil rights since the 1880s. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into Jamaica, where President Obama is heading, which has the most austere budget in the world.
A pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jake Johnston, a research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where his research focuses predominantly on economic policy in Latin America, the International Monetary Fund, and U.S. foreign policy. He is the lead author of the Center for Economic Policy Research's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog, and his new report is Partners in Austerity, Jamaica, the United States, and the International Monetary Fund. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jake Johnston.
Thanks for having me.
And President Obama is going to be visiting Jamaica on his way to Panama for the Summit of the Americas. And this country, which I'm learning about in terms of the work that you've done, I had no idea that Jamaica has the worst austerity situation in the world. It is essentially worse than Greece.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it hasn't gotten the attention of a lot of the sort of more high-profile situations like Spain and Greece, obviously, in Europe. But yeah, in fact, you know, when we looked, Jamaica's running a higher primary surplus. So this is so revenue minus expenditure, but taking out interest payments, higher primary surplus than any country in the world outside of major oil producers. Now, the major oil producers obviously are not running surpluses because of austerity, but just because they have so much revenue from the oil.
So its debt to GDP ratio is nearly 140%. Explain that.
Yeah, so the debt to GDP ratio is around 140%. Interestingly, that's actually not that far from where it was back when Jamaica signed their first of these previous two IMF agreements in 2010. Now, a more sort of telling indicator is actually what percent of GDP they're spending on interest payments. So, I mean, they have this high debt to GDP ratio, but what's really damaging is that they're spending such a high portion of their revenues on debt servicing. And Jamaica, even after these two debt restructurings that they undertook as part of the IMF agreements, are still paying over 8% of GDP a year in interest payments.
So this is like treading water, right? I mean, how do they get ahead if they're what is their principal form of revenue? Tourism?
Yeah, the tourism is certainly big, and there is some sort of manufacturing and other things. But you know, without sort of an effort, you know, right now the economic program is around cutting spending, trying to reduce the debt, and a lot of sort of business reforms and reforms to the public sector. Now, the IMF and the Jamaican government has been arguing that these are going to set the stage for this sort of long-term growth. But these are the same sort of policies we've been talking about for decades, and Jamaica's had 20 years of declining living standards. And sort of to put that out into the future and continue along with this austerity is just only condemning future generations to more of that.
So how long have they had the most austere budget in the world?
Yeah, well, so this, you know, Jamaica has suffered through these issues for a long time, the low growth and high debt. I mentioned earlier they've actually had negative average per capita GDP growth over the last 20 years. But it really sort of was exacerbated by the global recession started in 2009. So at that time, Jamaica's interest payments actually reached over 17% of GDP. Now, this is, you know, very much not sustainable. Jamaica turned to the IMF. They had a debt exchange, but unfortunately the debt exchange didn't actually reduce any of the principal. It just sort of extended it out further into time. And so what happened was that after a few more years of low growth, we saw the same thing repeat itself, where you'd have these really big interest payments coming due, and that the debt restructuring really didn't solve those underlying problems. So once again, Jamaica has turned back to the IMF, to another debt exchange, and committed to further years of austerity. And so really this most recent one started in 2012. The government implemented this very austere budget basically to win the confidence of the IMF to get a new IMF agreement, which they succeeded in 2013.
So that's like when you maxed out your credit cards, you get another credit card. How would you make that analogy, or you know, translate that analogy to the average citizen?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting sort of paradigm here. But with the IMF, I mean, you're seeing a lot of these loans from the IMF, and so it's like, okay, you'd think Jamaica would be getting lots of resources from this. But in fact, another thing we found when we looked at the data is that because of previous IMF agreements, Jamaica's actually been paying more to the IMF in previous interest payments and principal payments than they're actually getting in new loans. And so they're committing themselves to this severe austerity, but the actual financial benefit from the multilateral banks is virtually wiped out because of all of the interest payments they're paying right back to them. Interestingly, what's actually sort of kept the economy afloat during this time of austerity have been financial aid through Venezuela's Petrocaribe program and new investments from China in the last couple of years.
But essentially, they're borrowing money to service debt.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so you can see even with the Petrocaribe money from Venezuela, much of this is spent on sort of infrastructure projects and capital projects, the type of things that have been totally squashed through the austerity. But at the same time, a lot of those resources are also going down to paying the debt. And so you can see sort of this prioritization of paying down this debt over taking care of the future of your people, of the country, and setting the stage for that actual growth. And so this is a trade-off, and we can clearly see the prioritization of the International Monetary Fund and other world lenders.
And here we are paying attention to this small Caribbean island because the President of the United States, Barack Obama, is going to be visiting there in a couple of days on his way to Panama for the Summit of the Americas. He is representing the United States. The United States dominates the IMF. So do you think there's a certain amount of culpability or responsibility that the president's carrying with him in terms of this incredibly, you know, this trap of austerity that this tiny island nation is trapped in?
Certainly. I mean, as, you know, the largest voting participant in the IMF, the U.S. has a sort of unique role in that institution. There was also members of Congress that lobbied the IMF on Jamaica's behalf to actually get this IMF agreement put forward. But, you know, in fact, in the lead up to his trip down there today, there was a press conference today with some of his advisors, and they reiterated their strong support for Jamaica's efforts to deal with this debt crisis and actually cited their strong performance in the last 2 years working with the IMF. So I think you can just see sort of this divergent from reality. I mean, a strong performance as in they succeeded in following the IMF's budget advice. However, economic growth was actually negative in the last quarter. Unemployment has risen for three straight quarters. Poverty has doubled since 2007. Sort of describe this as a positive performance or a good outcome. Is really sort of disingenuous, certainly for those that haven't felt any benefit from it.
And you mentioned earlier that Jamaica would be even worse off but for financial support from Venezuela and investment from China. What exactly does Venezuela and China get in exchange for that?
Well, so Venezuela has the Petrocaribe energy program that provides oil to countries throughout the Caribbean and throughout the region. They have to pay a portion of that oil bill up front, and the rest is sort of turned into a long-term loan, generally around 20 years with about 1% interest. And so that's a primary avenue for Jamaica these days. It's actually averaged around 2.5% of GDP each year over the last 3 years, and that's according to the IMF, and even takes into consideration interest payments paid to Venezuela. To put that in perspective, there was actually an outflow of $136 million to the IMF from Jamaica last year.
And what are the Chinese investing in?
The Chinese are a number of sort of larger infrastructure projects in Jamaica, and again, this is how we see this sort of subsidizing the IMF program, or the aid and investment from Venezuela and China is actually sort of making the IMF agreement somewhat politically tenable, and the economy is not entirely collapsing over the last year or two. So these big infrastructure projects that are supported by both Venezuela and China are the types of projects that have actually been cut from the budget through this IMF program. In fact, if you looked at the 5 years before the IMF program, Jamaica averaged around 4 or 5% of GDP in capital expenditure. And this year they actually reached an all-time low of the last 20 years of 1.6% of GDP in capital expenditure. So you can see just how these sort of important investments are being cut out from the budget.
And in the case of Greece, where you made the point up front that Jamaica is even worse off than Greece in terms of its austerity, most of the loans, as far as I understand, that went to Greece came from private banks, mostly in Germany. And now, of course, the European Central Bank and the so-called Troika are essentially holding the Greek government responsible. And there's clearly some enormous back and forth going there. And the Greeks now are accusing the Germans of, or expecting the Germans to pay war reparations from World War II. So that's obviously become a very contentious situation. But in the case of Jamaica, the borrowing didn't come from just private banks, did it? Did they borrow from private banks, or did they borrow essentially from the IMF?
There is a significant portion of Jamaican debt that is owed both to domestic financial institutions as well as external financial institutions. But the multilaterals do have a very significant role in that. It's about half of Jamaica's external debt. So I mentioned previously the debt exchanges that Jamaica had done as part of these IMF agreements. Now, they didn't actually touch any of Jamaica's external debt. Now, this new agreement, we've seen additional loans from the World Bank, from the Inter-American Development Bank, and from the IMF. But what we saw with our research is that just by canceling previous interest payments and principal payments and no new loans whatsoever, that those organizations, the multilateral banks, would actually free up far more resources through debt relief than through these continued loans. I mean, I think, you know, if President Obama is traveling to Jamaica and sort of looking for alternatives to this situation, I think a clear one is to sort of use that position within the International Monetary Fund and within the other multilaterals to push for a debt relief mechanism, certainly for Jamaica, but Jamaica is not the only country in the Caribbean that's dealing with these issues. Grenada is another one, as well as Barbados, Antigua and Barbuda. These are countries that have had low growth, extremely high debt, and they're not as poor as some of the other countries that have benefited from debt relief in the past, and they sort of have been left behind in terms of any mechanisms to deal with it. But you see they're stuck in a very difficult situation now, and it's having a big impact on living standards.
But the thing that's particularly cruel, it would seem, about the Greek situation, and I'm wondering whether it's the same situation here with Jamaica, is that the irresponsible lenders, like in this case the Jamaican government, or in the case of Greece, the Greek government or past Greek governments, the irresponsible borrowers, like the Jamaican government, or in the case of Greece, like the previous Greek governments, they are the ones that get slammed. But the irresponsible lenders, the European banks or the IMF, in this case with Jamaica, they don't get blamed. So isn't that an odd situation where if you make bad loans, you don't get blamed? The person who received the bad loans gets blamed.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think, you know, when you're talking about the situation in Jamaica, it's almost worse in that the IMF not only was giving them the loan, but then dictating what their economic policies were. And so the economic policies also weren't appropriate to get them out of the recession or to reduce the debt. And so what you have is debt has actually increased. Interest payments are down a little bit, still one of the highest in the world. And yet the IMF is collecting more, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in interest payments and principal payments from Jamaica over the next few years.
So why is the president stopping off there? I mean, do you know what's on his agenda? Is he going to be addressing these issues? This is the most indebted, austerity-crippled country in the world. Maybe at least the president may be getting that talking point.
Yeah, I think, you know, sort of interesting dynamic here is that the Jamaican government, at least publicly, has been very supportive of the IMF agreement and talked up how well they've been complying with the IMF budget dictates. And so, to the extent that that Obama would meet with people outside of the government or people who have been, advocating around this issue for years now, he might hear that. And I think it's unfortunate that he probably wouldn't hear that from the government itself.
So is this a working trip? I mean, or is he going to have a couple of days in the sun? What's the plan here?
No, this is a working trip. Additionally to meeting with Portia Simpson Miller, the Prime Minister of Jamaica, they will have a bilateral meeting, but also heads of state from the rest of the CARICOM region, the Caribbean region, are also traveling to Jamaica. And so there will be a meeting between President Obama and the other heads of state from CARICOM on Thursday as well.
But you've mentioned that some of the other CARICOM countries are in the same boat as Jamaica.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, there is sort of increasing movements around sort of looking at ways that you could deal with this in a more systemic way. So not focusing just on Jamaica, but on issues of high debt and low growth for Caribbean nations in general. Jubilee Network, a great organization that's worked for debt relief for years, did launch last year with partners in the region a Caribbean Debt Relief Initiative. And so there are steps that are being taken to try and address this issue.
But is there any, in the case of China making investments in Jamaica, China and also Taiwan have been in competition for the longest time to get votes in the UN, and they often bribe these small island nations to get votes at the UN. Is that what's going on, and is there any subtext to China's loans, either to Jamaica or these other indebted Caribbean islands?
I wouldn't be able to speak specifically to China. I mean, I do think the U.S.'s involvement in the Caribbean at this point is at least partially in response to Venezuela's inroads in the region and the support that they give to the Caribbean through the Petro-Caribe Initiative. Certainly part of what President Obama will be discussing in the region is the U.S.'s own energy program for the region to provide support to these countries. And I think you could certainly see that in terms of a diplomatic tit-for-tat.
Well, there's no doubt that when he gets to Panama, he's going to get an earful from Venezuela, who the U.S. has just sanctioned. I mean, I think Maduro, who's every other day blames everything that's happening in his country on the United States, I'm sure he's going to take the opportunity to lambast Obama.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it would not just be him, but in fact the rest of the region as well, including the Caribbean, have spoken out forcefully against the unilateral sanctions of the U.S. on Venezuela. And so I don't think that's just a Venezuela issue, but in fact the region is pretty well united against that.
So this doesn't sound like much of a vacation, does it, for Obama? He's going to get an earful in Jamaica, and then when he gets to Panama, he's going to get another earful.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your expectation?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I think there was, an idea that this would be sort of a monumentous occasion to showcase the new Cuba policy in the region and to sort of generate this new era of goodwill. And I think the subsequent actions, certainly with Venezuela specifically, have sort of overshadowed that within the region. I think the issue with Jamaica, while it's certainly not going to get the sort of broad media attention that the rest of these issues are, certainly, is another big issue, not just for Jamaica, but again, for the rest of the Caribbean as well.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jake Johnston.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jake Johnston, who is a research associate at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, where his research focuses predominantly on economic policy in Latin America, the International Monetary Fund, and U.S. foreign policy. He's the lead author of the Center for Economic Policy Research's Haiti Relief and Reconstruction Watch blog, and his new report is Partners in Austerity, Jamaica, the United States, and the International Monetary Fund. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Molly Lewis. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.